Welcome to the Lost Debater Show for Political Eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and today we welcome back Bradley Tusk. He's been on this podcast a few times, but for those of you who are new to Bradley, he is the CEO and founder of Tusk Ventures, and really his specialty is helping companies scale and survive in highly regulated industries, which means he's a glutton for punishment. He also was the campaign manager for Bloomberg 2009 and is a veteran of politics, which he wrote about in a wonderful book called The Fixer. He also recently wrote a book called Obvious in Hindsight, which we talked about on this podcast not long ago, which is a wonderful fictional depiction of a CEO of a flying car company and draws a lot on Bradley's experience in all the industries that I alluded to. Bradley also has done a lot of work on hunger issues through Tusk Philanthropies. But I could talk about this forever. Bradley, welcome to the podcast. We've got a lot to talk about today.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
And you're coming at us from your bookstore / studio on the Lower East Side?
Yeah, I have to say, I'm like a little dismayed. So Ravi lived in the neighborhood of the store for years and years. And when I saw him pop up on the screen, I started giving him a little shit and saying, hey, man, couldn't you walk like 3 blocks? Like, we have a studio here. He sold out and moved to Brooklyn like everybody else.
I'll be back. You know, I am a little bored out here. I was born in Brooklyn, so it's a bit of a homecoming.
Which hospital were you born at?
Lutheran Medical Center, which is actually where my parents met each other. My dad's a doctor, my mom's a nurse. So, yeah.
Mine was Brookdale, which I'm not even sure. They might have to shut it down because it was so bad.
I don't even know that hospital yet. Now everything is the same. Now it's like Langone, Sinai, everybody
right,
owns
Northwell or whatever.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about a couple of quick things. Well, I mean, we'll get to health actually, because you wrote a really fascinating piece on your blog all about your wellness journey, which gave me anxiety, but we'll get to it. First big piece of news here this week, I wanted to start on a timely issue, which is Trump. There was a sort of head-turning scene happening in, you know, these very active New York City courts. And basically, he has 6 days to secure an appeal bond for this $500 million judgment in the civil fraud case happening here in New York. And on Monday, in court filings, his lawyers revealed that he'd been unable to secure an appeal bond despite, quote, diligent efforts that including approaching about 30 bond companies. He had previously been able to secure a $91.6 million bond in the E. Jean Carroll case from some insurance company. What do you think happens here?
Yeah, I mean, a few things. So one is, it's not that he can't pay the bond. It's that he couldn't get a bond that worked best for him financially, right? So he does own a lot of property, well in excess of $450 million. He could sell that property and fund a bond. What he didn't want to have to do was be in a position where he's selling in a fire sale and the vultures swoop in and he gets sort of a very low price. He wants to obviously maximize the value of his assets. And so he was trying to get the bond without having to be forced to sell any property. And of course, no insurer was going to do that. And so what will ultimately happen, I think, is that he will have to sell the building at, in Columbus Circle or Trump Tower or some asset that he has that is worth $450 million. I imagine that he's very good at tying things up in court. This is not going to all happen tomorrow. He's going to go to court and fight it. And it's going to be a little while until a judge says, yeah, you do have to get this bond. And then he'll probably fight it some more. But eventually, my guess is one of his marquee properties goes away in order to pay the bond.
Yeah, what's fascinating is that a lot of this is playing out, like, you know, of the many legal issues that Trump is facing, the ones that seem to be advancing fastest are happening here in New York. So we just talked about these 2 civil cases, but it looks like we're back to square one where the Bragg case, which is the, you know, you and I previously talked about this, is the weakest and probably the least sellable and probably the least ethical, in my opinion, of all the cases against Trump, is the one that is, it was originally slated to have jury selection 2 weeks. It looks like there was a document dump from the U.S. Attorney's Office, which was inexplicable to me, but they just dumped like 120,000 documents on Trump's lap, which Trump's lawyers very smartly kind of orchestrated this. But that looks like it's going to be bumped back to at least a month. And I'm left wondering, this is like bad on many levels. One is, if there is going to be a judgment, it looks like it's going to be on the weakest and most politically volatile of the cases. But it also looks like even if there is a judgment, it'll come from New York in all likelihood. There's some chance that some of the federal cases could be heard, and who the hell knows in Georgia. But it will inevitably be appealed, and we could be facing Trump on the ballot with, you know, this legal uncertainty in a state case that can't be pardoned hanging over his head.
Yeah, I mean, look, ultimately, though, I think the problem is, while there may be a situation where Trump owes a bunch of money or maybe does have some sort of state, you know, criminal liability, the real question is, can any of these legal issues meaningfully change the election itself? And it so far does not seem like it. And I think what you and I have talked about before and agreed is, you know, the Stormy Daniels case is not going to change a voter's opinion, whether it's they're for Trump or for Biden. I don't think that the Tish James civil settlement will either. But whereas the January 6th or the illegal documents or the Georgia election case, that's the kind of stuff that maybe could move some swing voters in Maricopa County or Cuyahoga County or whatever it is. And I don't think we're going to see those before the election. So while, sure, I'd love to see Trump suffer as much as possible, what I really want is for him not to be in the White House. And I don't think any of these legal efforts are going to prevent that.
Yeah. And I think this DOJ 60-day rule interpretation is, like, for those people who are hoping for a federal case, that was the only good news recently on that front, which is like a kind of, you know, a little discussed procedural announcement. The DOJ announced down in the documents case in Florida that their interpretation of, you know, if those remember Comey, remember the 60-day rule, is that the Justice Department doesn't like to make major legal announcements within 60 days of the election. They interpreted it narrowly down in Florida, saying that that's only for announcing new cases. In this case, they could see the sort of proceedings going up right until election day, which is hard to imagine. And this is where I think everybody needs to be careful. It's like, you know, I, like you, don't like Trump, don't want to see him in the White House. It's an understatement, but I also don't want us to burn down every legal norm and procedure en route to chasing him down. And I'm a little worried, especially when it comes to some of this New York stuff, that you could get anything done against Trump in New York. And even the judgment that we talked about, I'm no expert on these, and there's no real precedence on the kind of judgment that Trump had. It feels excessive based on what the fact pattern is.
Yeah, and not just that. I don't know that it's politically right to assume that if you can sort of achieve some of these legal victories, then that will change the perceptions of undecided or swing voters. You know, I think one of the mistakes the Democrats keep falling into is they think if the voters can just understand this one more really immoral thing that Trump said or did, then they'll realize how bad he is, and then they'll vote for Biden, or it won't be for Trump, whatever it is. They know. They are fully aware of exactly who this guy is, what this guy is, and when 47% of them are telling the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, that they prefer him, and only 42% is saying they prefer Biden, all 47% are fully aware of exactly what a piece of shit he is, and they are still choosing him anyway. So this notion that, like, moral outrage is going to win you the election or democracy is in danger, like, that's not the way you win. You win if people feel like their day-to-day lives under Trump over the next 4 years would not be as good as under Biden. And that's it.
Well, okay, let's move on to another sort of timely issue this week. So, you know, the House just passed this TikTok legislation. I'm now careful not to call it a ban because I'm thoroughly convinced that it's not, after being told multiple times it's not. The Senate now is holding hearings on this. Like, right now, there are closed door hearings. It looks like Lisa Monaco from the Justice Department is briefing senators who are skittish about this divestment bill. The lobbying activity seems to be in a frenzy. Kellyanne Conway appears to be lobbying on behalf of TikTok. Given how weird the Senate is, I don't have a good read on where this is going to go. It would be quite shocking, is not the right word, but I would say disappointing, given the bipartisan agreement on the threat to China, that we can't get this bill through, given how sizable the margins were on in the House.
Yeah, it shows you the lack of common sense, but there are so many different permutations at play. So number one, within the Democratic caucus, you have people like, say, Mark Warner, who are clearly in favor of the bill. And then people like Maria Cantwell, who are, you know, knowledgeable about tech, but are saying, well, maybe we need a different policy approach or a broader thing. So one is Democrats, as usual, can't get their act together internally to agree on a policy. They always let the perfect be the enemy of the good. So that's number one. Number two is Schumer's sort of politics on this is a little dicey because he has historically been the biggest defender and protector of the platforms, of Facebook, of Twitter, of Snap, whatever it is. And while obviously a Chinese-controlled company is a little different, he has always been the guy in the pocket of social media. So maybe that isn't going to change. Three, Biden is not putting particularly much pressure on this. And I think the reason why is they look at the polls and say, you know what? TikTok may be incredibly dangerous and destructive to American society, but it's also really popular. And there, Biden's worry about looking even older than he already is. And so they're not really applying much political muscle to it. So I think you put all that together and it's pretty uncertain. The one, and this is based on nothing other than the machination of my own brain and having worked for Chuck in the Senate for a couple of years, the one bit of hope that I have is that when Chuck came out last week on Israeli elections and called for them to have Netanyahu replaced, my thought was maybe what he was doing was buying a little bit of breathing room for himself and some of his candidates, both in the caucus and in the upcoming Senate elections, and use that ultimately to then push the TikTok ban through, or it's not the ban, the divestment, whatever it is, through. Because ultimately, the rise, I would argue, in anti-Semitism and anti-Israel among young people and among the left is in many ways been driven by TikTok, which I think is a deliberate effort by the Chinese government to sow discontent in the United States. Chuck's a smart man. He knows that. He certainly doesn't want there to be more anti-Semitism. So my hope maybe is this was part of a more elaborate play where he opened up some space on the left, and then that lets him get the TikTok bill through.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because, you know, you point to a dynamic within Biden's coalition where a big threat to his reelection effort is his standing with young people, either that they don't vote at all, or, you know, I could see, you know, more of them voting for Trump this time than last time. And it doesn't take a lot. And even the suppression issue is a big deal. The other thing going on here in paralleling this bill is that Trump had a rather puzzling about face on this. There's an interesting piece by Noah Smith that we'll put in the show notes. And also, I think David French also wrote a piece in the New York Times that was kind of an abbreviated, probably less thorough version of the same argument, basically speculating what the hell is going on with Trump. Some people are saying it was this meeting he had with this billionaire David Yass, who has a $33 billion stake in ByteDance, and Trump just met with this guy. Maybe that's what's going on. Who knows? But basically, and Yass also donated a ton of money to Vivek Ramaswamy, who also had an about face on this. I don't know what's going on, but needless to say, that in and of itself is troubling. And Smith argues in his piece that this is like in a long line of you can't trust Trump to ever hold any dictators accountable. He seems to have almost an undisputed record in backing dictators, even against American interests, which is disappointing. His position didn't seem to sink the bill in the House, as you know, in the way it did the immigration bill. But it seems like given the amount of people auditioning for vice president in the Senate right now, that he could make a huge difference here.
It could be a problem. And it also could be the excuse for Chuck to not move the bill and saying, well, there's only 10 Republican votes or whatever it is. And I only have 30. So therefore, the bill can't pass. So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely a risk. But look, more broadly, and I agree with everything that Smith's saying about not being able to trust Trump around dictators because he effectively is one himself or would like to be. But more broadly, we have now developed a political system where every politician makes every decision solely based on their own personal gain and benefit at the expense of everything else. And that's true on the left, that's true on the right. And for as long as all of the incentives in our political system are just to do whatever it takes to cater to a small group of people who actually bother to vote in the primary, which is all you really need for a re-election, then we're always going to have this world where no one's looking out for anything other than themselves, and we're not going to get anything done on any issue.
Yeah. And I'll point people to that article where I think this was one of the more thorough readings on what the problem with TikTok is. And it very credibly lays out that they've been suppressing any anti-China sentiment on the platform. And you talked about stuff that, you know, China has other opinions, right? Like whether it's the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or sowing mistrust in the U.S. political system, et cetera. Sometimes the things that they could be doing on this platform are quite subtle. In this case, the data is pretty like clear that anything basically critical of China is not in any way trending on TikTok in the way that it was on Instagram. And Smith kind of points out that this, you could imagine a world where this is a huge problem, where China invades Taiwan. And just like with Ukraine, there's a muddy American political debate going on. And China could use its incredible influence with young people and all the 170 million users on TikTok to tilt that debate in favor of inaction, which could cost a ton of people their lives and lead to massive global instability.
Yeah. I mean, look, the basic question is, do you want to give a foreign adversary that doesn't even have rule of law direct line into your kids' pockets and into their brains, right? I just don't know anyone that could possibly rationally say, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's let that happen. But that's exactly what is happening. And for once, we saw the House actually act intelligently and responsibly in sort of a strong bipartisan vote on the TikTok bill. And if the Senate can't get their act together for whatever one of 10 different reasons to move this thing forward, then you know what? We kind of deserve what's coming to us. If we are not competent enough to at least take this very, very clear bad idea and threat that's already occurring, it's not a theoretical risk, it's an actual problem today, and we can't do anything about it after the bill's already passed one chamber of Congress, then, you know, shame on us. And then you get to the question of, do we have a political system that's even worth saving in the first place?
Well, you mentioned Chuck Schumer, and, you know, what is fascinating is, like, you said he's been a defender of the social media companies. His politics are interesting to me, like, because his politics are, have traditionally been New York first. Like, he's a really good steward of New York interests, and he's everywhere all over the state. You know, I went to Binghamton. He'd be up in Binghamton one day, be in Staten Island the next. You know, he's just is everywhere. And I think he's generally been a really good steward of New York interests. And in part, like, the sort of sellout label of him has largely been tied to New York-based businesses like Wall Street, for example. People say he's sellout. And so most of his politics have been explainable to me. Whether I agree with them or not, a different story, but they're explainable by saying this is a New York guy who looks after New York interests. The social media stuff, I have never been able to truly grasp. Like, what's the genesis of his, like, extreme sort of defense of social media? Well, okay, I knew that. I went to law school with Jessica Schumer, but I feel like that's too simple of an answer.
Maybe you have a kid that works in the policy division of Facebook, whose only goal in life is to prevent the repeal of Section 230, and then the guy who has the ability to block the bill is doing so, you know, sometimes a cigar is a cigar.
Yeah, okay. Well, that was the simple answer, okay. Yeah, I mean, it's weird, honestly. And I'm not like a big, like, regulate the social media companies guy. I just always find it interesting when somebody, you know, for reasons that aren't obvious, takes on an issue like this. I'm generally skittish on these types of regulations.
I don't know. I mean, let's just real fast. So Section 230 for the listeners is a provision in a law passed in 1996 that says that social media platforms can't be held legally responsible for the content posted by its users, which certainly made sense at the birth of the internet to get it going. But now we have this forum that is massively more pervasive and popular and used than any other form of media by far. And whereas the New York Times or Fox News or whoever else are held to certain standards, which then allow for certain levels of responsible behavior, the platforms are completely immune from all of that. And so all their economic incentives are to push as much toxic content as they possibly can. And I don't know why we keep giving them a free pass to do this. Not does it lead to the destruction of our politics, at least are things like teaching teenage girls how to cut themselves and how to develop eating disorders. And the stuff that we keep seeing time and time again from these platforms is beyond repulsive, and we're not doing anything about it.
I just think it's, like, so practically difficult to, when you have that many users, you know, we're talking about 170 million users on TikTok, to police what goes on your platform. And I think, like, the thing that I worry about on it, and I'm definitely persuadable on this, I wouldn't say this is a hard belief I have, is that I'm worried about regulatory capture. These are companies that are already the most powerful entities, forget companies, but most powerful entities in the world. And that if we were to erect this barrier to say, okay, if you're, you know, Tusk social media platform would be impossible to get off the ground in a world where you have to do that.
Well, let me flip it around. And this is why I've been a big advocate for what Lina Khan has been doing on the FTC side. And keep on. So I'm an early stage venture capitalist. I invest at companies really early in their life, seed and series A. I have never invested in any sort of competitor to Meta, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, or Apple. And you know why? Because they have so much monopolistic power that there's no way that this tiny startup that I put $3 million into or $6 million, whatever it is, could ever possibly compete. And so as a result, I would argue that what we have right now with this massive lack of actual competition in the marketplace is leading to a lack of innovation, is leading to a lack of competition. And so sure, I would repeal Section 230. At the same time, I would also strengthen the FTC's powers and really prosecute all five of those companies as aggressively as possible and try to break them up.
Yeah, I'm with you on the breaking up part of it. I think these companies are just frankly too powerful. And the sort of consumer interest sort of standard that we've used traditionally just doesn't work in the context when you're not, when the user is the sort of, like the user data is what they're collecting, not necessarily their funds. You have to update your thinking on this kind of stuff. And as you know, I'm sure, and our audience will know this, we've talked about it. This new standard in antitrust is only a few decades old. Like we had traditionally, for the history of our country, viewed power in and of itself as a problem. Like if you concentrate too much of it in one person's hands, then, or one company's hands, then that in and of itself is a reason to break up a company, even if the price question is a little muddy.
And to protect the economy long-term. So look, what goes up must come down, right? So as amazing as those companies seem, they are subject to the laws of gravity, which means eventually they will grow stagnant and bureaucratic and political, and they will cease to be the wonders of innovation that they are today.
I mean, look at Google.
When
with
that
Gemini.
Happened,
look at what just happened
right,
with Gemini.
Right. We may already start to be seeing it with Google. Exactly. When that happens, then there's going to be one of two things. Either new entrants to the marketplace have been funded and supported, and they have the opportunity to step up, create that and provide that innovation, and fill the hole in the economy so we don't lose a ton of jobs and a ton of economic development. Or it's more like a communist system where it's completely stagnant because everything is controlled just by one entity. And then when that entity falls short and fails, which it invariably will, there's nothing to take its place. And then guess what? Some platform from some other country is going to step up and take it from them. And so, for the long-term benefit and value of the U.S. economy, you've got to have constant competition. You've got to have constant innovation. And allowing anyone, whether it's Standard Oil or Ford Motor Company or Bell Labs or Meta, to have this monopolistic control over their industry is really bad for the economy.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Like, I've held on to the sort of Magnificent Seven stocks for the past few years as like a, like, I don't, like, for the percentage of things that I trade on my own, this is basically the only stuff that's outside of index funds for me. And obviously anybody who's been following this stuff knows that it is trend bending the way that the sort of top seven stocks in the sort of tech sector have outperformed the most talented hedge fund managers, index funds, everything, where every piece of financial advice people have been given in the past is just put your money in an index fund, et cetera. And if you listen to some of these sort of doomsayers like Jeremy Grantham, who have traditionally been very critical of anything other than a very safe, put your money in an index fund, even he's saying, well, if they're not going to enforce antitrust laws, actually a safe bet is to put your money in these companies, which are totally like—
Right, sure. Why wouldn't you?
Right. Yeah. And an interesting part of this is last week I was debating this guy, Stephen Kent, who was on our podcast about the Gemini scandal. And he was like, this is the end of the company and all this. And I was like, look, man, I'm holding on to as much Google stock as I am. I would almost buy more because first of all, they're going to fix that one little thing. But the second thing is, the amount of data they're sitting on and the dominance that they have in the market, like they can be lazy, as you're saying, and they'll still print money. And the biggest thing that, like, I actually think one of the biggest pieces of business news this year just kind of went by this week, which is the Gemini Apple partnership that's cooking up right now, which is Apple's announcing that they're going to, I mean, potentially, we'll see if this goes through, that Apple will be using Gemini, using Google AI on the Apple devices, which, this is huge. These are two of the biggest companies in the world partnering together. Now, in a world where there was true competition, Apple would be developing their own AI. So it would be Apple versus Google versus OpenAI, which is essentially Microsoft. But now we basically only have Microsoft versus Google. That's all we have right now, essentially, in the sort of powerhouse AI.
And whatever Elon Musk is cooking up.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I'm not holding my breath on that.
Who knows?
Yeah. And like, and by the way, he was at the table OpenAI too. So it's like the incestuous nature of this, I think, is a problem. And it's for business reasons. Like, I think people who listen to this podcast, we got a lot of people on the right. If you listen carefully, it's not because capitalism is bad. It's because this is not really capitalism anymore, like at a certain point. Like if there's only one player or two player, then you don't have true competition.
Yeah, it's anti-capitalism. Capitalism is the best economic system ever created by an order of magnitude because it has done more to raise quality of life and standards of living across the globe and lift billions and billions of people out of poverty than any system ever could. With that said, capitalism thrives on there being true innovation and true competition. And it doesn't matter, even if it's a private sector company listed on the NASDAQ, the New York Stock Exchange in the United States of America, if it has complete monopolistic power and is able to sort of stifle any other competition, that's not capitalism.
let's turn our attention to, you know, New York City and this sort of blue city backlash. We did a segment on it last week in response to the election results in San Francisco, where they passed a few referenda, essentially backtracking on some of the defund type of language and basically like restoring some common sense on the streets. New York City has been embattled in its own way. We just had a shooting in the subway system a couple of days ago. We've had National Guard or whatever, or state troopers, I forget, presence.
Both, actually.
Presence in the subway system. I mean, you notice it. I notice it. Like, there's cops everywhere now in the subway system. And we also are dealing with this massive migrant debate going on within New York City, where we can't seem to erect structures to put people into. We can't seem to take care of them. We can't seem to get them on planes to go elsewhere. We can't seem to educate them. And this is the city with the Statue of Liberty sitting in its harbor. You can only imagine what's happening all across the country. What does this say about blue city governance?
You know, I think in a weird way, and I'm not a huge fan of Eric Adams, our mayor. I think he's been very, very ineffective as mayor. But I do think that when he says that the city's right to shelter requirement that makes the city have to provide housing for the migrants is just impossible to live with and to work with, I think he's right. So my view is we should have massively more immigration. Ultimately, this country is probably too small. Our population is too small and too old. We have too many people who are baby boomers that are going to need Social Security and Medicare. And we need a lot more younger taxpayers coming in. And the birth rate is not great enough to do that. So rather than being Japan, we should be letting in millions and millions and millions of more people. With that said, and I'm a first-generation American, just like you are, I think, and most people, when they come to this country, they don't come so because they think they're going to get free housing. They come here because they think that there's opportunity and they will sacrifice and struggle, but they will ultimately build a better life, which is exactly what my family did. I don't think we have to provide housing and shelter to migrants in order to get the level of immigration that we need to be good for the economy and good for the country. I don't think people expect that. And so it seems to me that we're kind of creating a problem that doesn't have to exist, which is, if you were to say, great, welcome, and you know, you go find your jobs and your housing, just like immigrants have been doing in this country for hundreds of years, and that will be a boost to our economy and our tax base and everything else, that would work. And then, by the way, if you didn't have to spend billions of dollars on this right to shelter, that money could go to mental health services for people who are on the subways and mentally ill or causing problems. That money could go to creating more affordable housing. There's so many better things we could do with the money. And so I think part of it is we just have this, especially in New York City. And again, I think Adams is corrupt and incompetent. But I think in this particular case, he is saddled with a law. And the real question becomes, you know, and I see this with Adams time after time again, he asked for permission instead of begging for forgiveness, right? So when I ran all the Uber campaigns to legalize the company, the sort of big question was, do you ask a city, hey, can I operate this new ride-sharing service here? Or do you just do it and then see what happens and fight them on it? We generally just did it, right? And it worked all over the U.S. Adams, to me, has become the epitome of asking for permission. Oh, you know, even though we know the right answer is to sort of just let the migrants sort of figure it out on their own like they have for hundreds of years, we can't because a court said we're not allowed to. Or, oh, even though we know that the right way to close illegal weed shops is just to padlock them and let them sue and we'll deal with it in the future, we can't because they don't want us to. I mean, there's a real failure to just take the ball and run with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's fascinating. And would the best scenario here be lifting this sort of temporary restriction that people have when they come here where they can't work, from what I understand?
Yeah, for sure.
So just lift that, let people work, forget about all this like right to shelter, all this kind of stuff. New York just cannot construct anything. Like the idea that they have a right to shelter, we've somehow created a city where we don't have any hotels, but the hotels unions control everything to the point where you can't get an Airbnb. Like we all pay way too much for our mortgages or rents or whatever, but we can't Airbnb unless you Airbnb for a month. So that also puts more pressure on the hotels. And these are also the same structures they're trying to repurpose to somehow house migrants. It's like, they ask the impossible of people, which is in the part why I think people are leaving.
Yeah, and the reality is, you know, look, immigrants are very good at going to where the opportunities are. So I think about like when my family came to this country in the 1950s from the refugee camps in Germany after World War II. My family happened to come to Brooklyn because we had a cousin there that sponsored them. And my grandfather opened up a tiny little sweater store on the Lower East Side, which is called P&T Knitwear, which is now the name.
Oh, is that where that name comes from?
Yeah. That's why I named it P&T Knitwear. But they had friends who went to Laredo, Texas, because they got into the duty-free business, or Louisville, Kentucky, or, you know, people went to where the opportunities were. And I think that that works just fine. So the market can figure a lot of this stuff out. You know, sometimes the right answer is a little less government, and there are really smart people. And I think, generally speaking, you know, we want as many immigrants as we can get, and I think we can trust them to know how to take care of themselves.
Yeah, New York City's losing population. And so the idea that we can have some people come in here and fill needed jobs and add some vitality, it's always going to be messy. And this is where I would say to some of my friends on the right is, let's look at data, right? Like, I know that there's like trading of anecdotes, like what did this person do? What did that person do? Like, look at the data. Like, when at the turn of the century, when immigrants were coming in just unfathomable numbers through New York City's harbors, there was crime, there was unrest, there was density, there was messiness, but per your point, there was less government. So it was just people kind of figured things out. They used their social networks. They used sort of community to take care of a lot more, and people just got shit done. You know, you fast forward a few decades, those are some of the sort of most upstanding members of a given community who, you know, you're right over here down the street on Smith Street or Court Street. Almost every business on those streets were started by immigrants. And I'm sure the same thing is true on the Lower East Side, probably more so Lower East Side than
right. I'm literally sitting here on Orchard Street, right, where probably every single business right has been.
So I would want a little give and take for people. It's like this. I do think it is in the long term interest of our country to figure this out and not just totally close off our borders. But I think the people on the right are right that it's so chaotic and it's also nonsensical. Like the idea that we're using the asylum system as the cover for this process both does injustice to the people who have true asylum claims and to the people who are just like waiting in line, who are doctors, nurses, teachers, you know, people who can do jobs that we absolutely need, or even the people who have a justifiable business claim to be here, like even people who could probably do service jobs, which was the most of the 90s immigration that happened here. Now we got full families here coming who can't care for themselves, in part because of our laws, but in part because they're not coming here for strictly employment reasons.
And also, look, I mean, this is just another example of how broken our underlying system is, right? So 70% of people in this country would say, we should neither have wide open borders, nor should we deport people who are here illegally. And yet that 70%, they don't vote in congressional primaries. They don't vote in any primaries. And so the 15% who do on each side have much more extreme views. And the only incentives for people in office are to follow the beliefs of that 15% in their party because they want to get reelected, and so we can't get anything done. 70% of people would say we should either confiscate everyone's guns that they have, nor should it be easy to buy an assault weapon. And yet again, they don't vote. I mean, the reality is we have consensus on most issues, even abortion. 2/3 of Americans agree that there should be some right to abortion. Now, you can debate 10 weeks versus 13 versus 16, whatever, but nonetheless, even our most controversial issue isn't actually that controversial. The problem is so few people participate in the system that they're the only ones with any power because they're the only ones that determine re-election, which is why I've been pushing mobile voting. We've talked about this before on this podcast, because to me, the only way that we're going to fundamentally change behavior is to change primary turnout. And we're going to change primary turnout is to stop making people go somewhere on a random Tuesday to vote in a city council primary and let them vote on their phones. That is how we legalized Uber all over the US and a bunch of other technologies that I've worked on since then. And until we actually make it easy and meet people where they are, we're always going to be in this mess.
In New York, not only do we ask people to go to somewhere on a random Tuesday, they have to do it multiple times a year for tons of obscure offices. There's way too many offices in the city, but that's a whole other discussion. Like I once tallied up all the different offices that a given person in a four-year cycle is responsible for voting for. Like, you'd have to be a political scientist to truly understand what it is you're voting for half the time in some of these races.
Yeah, in some ways, I thank God I'm an independent. I'm not allowed to vote in the primary, so reduces my obligation.
And some of them are just made-up positions with absolutely no real power.
Public advocate, borough president, yeah.
Yeah, those are the two. You know, there's this guy, William Winter, who ran for tax collector in Mississippi in the 80s on the platform that he would dismantle the office. And he did that. I want to see people do that for public advocate and borough president in the city. So Bradley, you wrote this article called My Wellness Routine is Killing Me. The subtitle is I've been on a wellness kick the last few years, both for my physical and mental health. Summarize for us. This was a funny anxiety-inducing ride here. Tell me what's been going on in your world. You're almost like the Brian Johnson of
a little bit. I mean, not quite as crazy, but so I just turned 50, and you know, I started sort of getting a little bit into the what can I do to sort of maximize my health and lifespan, and I'm not like infusing the blood of, you know, young Germans or anything like that.
You're not electrocuting your testicles yet.
Yeah, not hanging upside down all for 15 minutes. But what I did do was, did you read Peter Attia's book, Outlive?
Yeah, I actually have it right here.
Yeah. So I read that. And what I did was I made a list of all the different tests he talked about, because the point that Attia makes is there's a lot of data out there that technology could now generate that your GP and your annual physical isn't doing, that you could learn about your health, your genes, your organs, everything else. And that could let you prevent problems from occurring and ultimately add years, decades to your life. So I made a list of every single one of those tests, and I did them all. And it was like 20 different things, you know.
And so just to give people, you did the full body MRI, which we've talked about. We'll link in the show notes. We Drew Kolar from the New Yorker and I both did the Prenovo scans and compared our results recently on the pod. DEXA scan, great company. Carotid artery scan, VO2 max test, which T has a lot of data. He basically says that's his favorite metric for longevity. The Galeri multi-cancer test, I've never heard of that. A clearly heart scan. My dad actually, interestingly, Bradley, did a heart scan 2 weeks ago from a company down on Wall Street, and they found such significant blockages in four arteries that they basically sent him straight up to the hospital for quadruple bypass surgery.
Yeah.
APOE test, a colonoscopy, an endoscopy, a full body dermatology scan. You did your glucose and insulin levels, your PSA levels, your vision, your teeth, basically everything.
Yeah, look, and so there's good news and bad news. The good news, one, I'm in pretty decent shape. Two, the things that they have found are things that you can deal with and I'm dealing with. But the problem is this: when you take the totality of everyone's advice and instructions, it becomes overwhelming, right? And so, for example, protein. So the nutritionist that I talked to said you need 1.7 grams of protein per kilogram of your weight. So for me, that comes out to like 132 grams of protein. That's a lot of protein, man. Like I can't eat. And then they're like, but you can't eat too much red meat. And it's like, or you don't have saturated fats. It's like, what do you want, have salmon like six times a day? Like I can't do it. Or like Attia talks about how important grip strength is. And the guy spends hours a week on his grip strength. I don't have fucking hours a week to spend on my strength. Or even when I did my VO2 max test, the cardiologist said, listen, I want to change your workout, your cardio routine, and go to zone two training, which is a lower heartbeat, kind of that 120-ish
per minute rate
for me at my age of 50, as opposed to what I was doing, which was more in the 140s, 150s, even 160s, but do it 5 days a week for half an hour. So that's five. I live with my trainer, three. That's eight workouts a week. There aren't 8 days in a week, right? And right. So the reason I wrote the piece is I'm trying to be good. I'm trying to do everything right. And by the way, I am lucky, right? I have a tremendous amount of flexibility and autonomy in my schedule. I have a huge staff of people to help me with stuff. I have plenty of resources. I mean, I've got it as good as you can get. And I don't know how to do all of this. And so, you know, the piece was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it's kind of like, how are you supposed to do all this? I don't. What do you do?
Well, I'll tell you my journey on this. I don't think we've ever talked about this. For 4 years, I've been running a fitness and wellness community that started just for friends, and only this past year did I turn it into a beta test of an actual app that we built and everything. And essentially, what we do is it's a competition. It's both individual competition, but also we create teams, and people compete against each other to be more healthy. And essentially what I've done is take the body of data that you have discovered and turned it into, like, I prioritize it, and then people get points for being healthy. So you get points for, and we have what it's called Squadra is the name of the company. And You get points for all kinds of workouts, but I've picked 10.
And is it just exercise or is it also diet and sleep and mental health?
There are three categories. There's exercise, there's habits, which include, did you drink alcohol, yada, yada. We don't really go near sleep just because the data is too variable from person to person. And then third is biomarkers, where you only have to track one biomarker. So basically what I try to do is I give people access to 10 biomarkers that they can track. And when you put your biomarker into the system, it spits you back a qualitative metric. So for instance, some of the charts and studies that Peter Attia is pulling from, for example, on ApoB, for example, when you put in your ApoB number, it'll spit back, say, you're in the X percentile according to your sex and age, et cetera. And here's like a bunch of studies that you do. So basically what I've done is, and on the workout side of things, I work out a lot. I, you know, play tennis almost every day when I can. I lift a lot of weights, et cetera. But the way I've built the program is there are 10 workouts that if you can get the 10 done in a week, and some of them don't take very long. One of them is like a plank hold, right? But you get those 10 done, and they're very much based on some of the stuff Attia and others say. Like, you know, like he talks about farmer's carry. He talks about the dead hang pull-up. But then there's certain things like deadlifting. You know, I've gotten people deadlifting, squatting, things like that. And so people get points for those. They track their PRs, all that kind of stuff. And then they do healthy habits, but they get points for them. And basically the gist of it is, don't be perfect. It just gives you a sort of, some people take the competition super duper seriously. And some people just want to be their team. They don't want to let their team down. And they also like the visibility and the Hawthorne effect of it makes them healthy. And what we found is that people on average in this program are losing body fat, gaining muscle, reporting back like super success. Like our net promoter on the most recent survey is a 9.2 out of 10. And so basically what I'm doing
is- company is like 0.01.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, you and I were talking offline about some of the projects I'm offloading in the next 2 months. My big goal for the second half of this year is to take what I've learned and make it more scalable and interesting.
How have you factored in people's usage of GLP-1s into all this?
Well, we don't. So I've, you know, the same New Yorker interview I did, we talked about GLP-1s and I actually experimented with it myself. My dad is a physician and I did like 2 months or something on it. And actually, I don't want to out my dad. He is actually the one who prescribed it to me. But I got my hands on some of it early on and I've experimented with it. I actually talked about it on this podcast. The audience got really mad at me, so I stopped talking about it. But I experimented with it. I clearly, obviously, am not in the sort of category of people who should be using it. And I learned a lot. I lost some weight. It was really uncomfortable. And I went off of it and gained the weight that I lost back, just like they said I would, and realized it's not for me, but it's a very powerful drug.
Yeah, I've had pretty severe OCD my whole life and have been tried it and then just started again, Mounjaro, for compulsive thinking. And they don't know whether or not it can help with it. But, you know, what they keep learning, what's interesting about GLP-1s is it was, you know, created as an obesity drug, a diabetes drug, and turns out because in the same way that it reduces cravings for food, it's been very helpful with addictions for all kinds of things, you know, gambling, alcohol, drugs, whatever it is. And when you have OCD, they don't really know much about it yet. They don't really understand what causes it. And the only medication there is for it, I've been taking it forever, but it's just SSRIs to mitigate the symptoms when something happens. So they're less bad for me if I've taken the SSRIs than not, but it has nothing to do with preventing the underlying event in the first place. And there was some speculation out there. They're like, hey, maybe these same properties would be useful for compulsive thinking. And so I'm actually trying it out to see if I can.
We got to have you back to see how that goes. I think, you know, they certainly, the data on alcohol makes sense. And I felt it like, you know what it's like to take this stuff. You don't want to, you kind of have like a, at least to me, I had like an ambient just nausea. Like I just felt nauseous all the time, but not enough to like throw up or anything. But it was just like, and what I realized is, at least the current iterations of it, the downsides are real. Like, you know, you can't, like, it also elevates your heart. So if you're playing tennis or you're working out, it also has certain negative effects on building muscle. So all the protein stuff that you're talking about becomes way harder in a world where you're taking these drugs. It probably has some effect on the uptake of that protein, which is already hard to begin with. And, you know, as you mentioned in your article, like, what is it? How much do you take? I try to get the gram per pound of body weight myself. And there's some days where I'm better than others. I have my own tricks, but it also has its downside.
Do you make it?
Well, okay. I have like a whole world of this where I bought an ice cream maker, the Ninja, and I make protein ice cream. And I basically, the only ingredients in my protein ice cream are, I found a casein protein, which absorbs better. So it's whey protein, almond milk and like this sugar-free Jell-O part, which is like garbage.
So there's no saturated fat or sugar in it?
No.
How does it taste?
Pretty good. I was actually thinking of opening, you know, in a world where I could split myself in five, I would open like a little
protein ice cream shop.
I think it would do pretty well.
I'll give you, you know what? Put a cart outside the bookstore.
Yeah, there you go.
I'll give you some space here.
Yeah, we'll do. We should test it out. Especially at late at night on the Lower East Side where people are like, okay, I want to have like a guilt-free snack, you know, like I feel like people would be into it.
I always thought that the person who can invent diet weed where, you know, there's no, either it doesn't have munchies or even actually gets you to stop eating as much, like that's a $1 billion idea.
Well, so the thing is I'm always on the hunt for whatever. So I bought this ninja thing and I'm making the ice cream. I always start my day with both a protein shake and eggs just to like get protein to begin with. And then it's just like the race, like for lunch, whatever I'm eating for lunch is protein after this. So it'll either be chicken or it'll be lentil pasta or something and then salmon for dinner. It's basically always taking protein and I take at least two shakes a day. These are downsides to this. Like people listening would be like, yes, there are certainly downsides to all of that. But I get pretty close to it every single day and I'm pretty freaking strong. Like I can deadlift over 500 pounds. And this is like part of what we do in the group is like we really focus on muscle building because as Tia puts in the book, nobody 70 years old is saying I have too much muscle.
Right. That's the biggest risk of the GLP-1s is sarcopenia, I think.
Yeah.
Because if you, right, like I work really hard to maintain muscle mass. And while if there is a relief from the OCD, that will be unbelievably life-changing for me. And the early data says that that might be true. Now, I don't know if it's true because it's true or because it's psychosomatic, but it's right. Kind of the same thing.
Right.
Right. But yeah, I mean, the real trick is going to be, how do you not lose your muscle mass while getting the benefits of these drugs? Because yeah, when you're 80, 90, 70, the weights you lift in your 50s are the whole thing.
Yeah. And I, the thing about like your piece that made me think about, you know, when you drill down on Atiyah, who's I think among the smartest people on this kind of stuff. And certainly his book is a great summary for people who don't have it. It's called Outlive, but his service, I'm sure you're a subscriber. I pay for his service and he, you know, even this week he wrote a long piece about protein uptake, which was really helpful. And he's very scientific. So if you really like to get into the chemistry of it all, he basically says like, if he gun to his head, what's the one thing he recommends to people is consistent exercise. And I think that's smart. And also helps you think through like the world of pharmaceuticals and all this kind of stuff. What do you take? What do you not take? Like, so for me, I take statins because my family has a long history of cardiovascular disease. We were just talking about my dad. I take rapamycin and acarbose, which is like a combination that has shown strong longevity benefits. People could read about it from Atiyah's work.
You take NAC?
No, I messed around with all the kind of NAD stuff and NMN and all that kind of stuff, but I'm not convinced that the data is good there. And there's actually been some, I forget what the study was that, you know, David Sinclair is sort of the main proponent of this kind of stuff. People want to look up his book, Lifespan. But there's been a lot of like mixed data on it. And there's also some negative. Recently, something came out. I think it might have been like elevated cancer risk or something. And Sinclair had to tweet out about it. It's just to me, it's like it hasn't been. I had done the drip before. I'd done the pills before. I just am not convinced the data is strong.
Where do you, so for Atiyah and the sort of for the listeners who haven't read the book, the first 60% of the book is kind of the evolution from medicine 2.0 to 3.0 and effectively how all of this different types of testing and technology can really get you information about yourself, you know, years, decades earlier. And then the other 40% are his specific routines on exercise, diet, sleep, and mental health. And you're right. He says that exercise is clearly, in his view, the most important by far. He actually kind of says diet, like you can kind of hurt yourself with a bad diet. He doesn't think that it's
he doesn't have
the
strong opinions on himself. Diet. You know, yeah. my sense in listening to him is that his advice on diet is pretty simple. Don't eat significantly more calories than you consume. You probably want to have a slight deficit if you want, or at least be at equilibrium, and avoid processed sugars. And basically, that's kind of where he ends. And avoid alcohol as much as you can. But even he says he drinks every now and then.
Just a little bit.
Yeah.
So how do you factor in the other two pieces, sleep and mental health, into the overall your overall program?
Yeah, I think everybody kind of comes from their own place, right? Like for me, on mental health stuff, I haven't had chronic issues that people who deal with like major depression or anxiety, things like that. But I have experimented a lot with psychedelics, and I know it's almost like a stereotype. But to me, that has made a huge difference in my life.
Oh, I did ketamine therapy and thought it was transformative.
Yeah. Did you do it in a clinic here?
No, you know, I actually just did it telemedicine and self-administered. I followed the program and you kind of threw, you talked to a doctor before the first couple of times that you do it. I, you know, in a way, when I asked my GP and my psychiatrist, like, hey, what do you think? The reason why they were pretty comfortable with it is, at least in the telemedicine version of it, the dosage is pretty low. So their view was, it's kind of like the same advice I got now about taking Mounjaro for compulsive thinking. They're like, you know what? Sure. If it helps, great. If it doesn't, no harm, no foul. The thing that I learned, so I really feel like I got ketamine therapy right. And when I talk to a lot of people who sort of do it and they don't get the results that I get, two things were to me really important. The first is, what ketamine does is it temporarily increases the neuroplasticity of your brain. So when you're a kid, you can absorb thoughts, emotions, concepts like a sponge, and then our brain calcifies. And as we get older and older, we get more rigid in our thinking. And the increase in neuroplasticity temporarily allows you to absorb new concepts. So I went into ketamine saying, okay, there's this issue where I intellectually understand one thing to be true, but I can't process it emotionally. I need to reconcile these two things. Let me use that increase in neuroplasticity to be able to do that. And then the other is, I really followed the program, right? So I did all of the journaling and all of the writing that it required before. And then after each session, I wrote myself a memo of whatever I learned from that session. Like the first one I did to me was maybe the most important thing I've ever written for myself, which is, I made a list of all my good qualities and all my bad qualities. And for the first time in my life, instead of saying, I hate myself for these bad qualities, or here's how I'm going to fix all these bad qualities, I said, you know what? They're fine. None of these are hurting other people. And you're hurting yourself far more by hating yourself for these things. And the fact that, yeah, you're a human being. You have flaws. It's okay. And I did that six times and combined it into about a 25-page document, which I then read two or three times a day, every day for about 6 months until I fully internalized it. And the combination of the neuroplasticity increase physically and then sort of emotionally, intellectually, the information that I kind of realized and then just kept internalizing day after day just made a world of difference for me.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And the journaling was another thing I was going to mention. So I'm glad you mentioned it, which is like the combination of journaling and whatever it is, whether it's therapy or psychedelics or psychedelics induced therapy, which basically is essentially what you're describing and is a little bit like how I do it, which is I do it with a person who's like an expert who, you know, walks you through a guided discussion where you sort of organize your key takeaways. And I do it with the same person. Whenever I do like a heroic dose, I do it with her. And then I continue to do, because it's essentially decriminalized here in New York. So then I continue to do it in lower doses pretty on a pretty regular basis. And I find that it, like you said, you know, and I'm not as familiar with the mechanisms of ketamine, but with psilocybin mushrooms, it's not like a lot of other drugs where it's like it's basically inducing a hormonal or an active response. What it's doing is it's suppressing a part of your brain called default mode network. There's a great book called How to Change Your Mind. I'm sure you've read this book by Michael Pollan.
Michael Pollan, yeah.
Where it's basically it's suppressing this part of your brain, which essentially is the thing that makes your brain more efficient and is the site of your ego and prevents you from kind of scattering your thoughts all over your brain. So when it temporarily suppresses that, and I could be butchering the science, it basically does what you're saying, which is it allows you to explore the rest of your brain, and it also allows you to experience an ego-free experience. And that has all sorts of benefits. It allows you to examine yourself without judgment. It allows you to forgive people and yourself. It allows you to explore memories and latent emotions. And the biggest thing for me is that I grew up in Staten Island where I had a very tumultuous childhood. I was a very emotional kid. And I learned over time to just control myself. And I realized over time, I've become almost robotic in how I've controlled myself. And when I do the psilocybin, it allows me to get in touch with my emotion again in a way that I hadn't since I was a kid. And that has been invaluable.
Do you meditate?
You know, it's interesting. It's part of our program. And it actually was added because people have asked for it. And so I've been doing it more since I've done this, but I don't think I know how to meditate. And it's actually something I'm long on my list.
So here's the, like you, I mean, you and I, one of the reasons I think we get along well is we have these very overactive brains and we're interested in a million different things and we're trying a million different things.
Yeah.
And so meditation ultimately is the same thing as like going to the gym, which is just get the reps in. You know, there are days we have a great workout. There are days where it's a shitty workout. But even when it's a shitty workout, you're like, it's still good. As long as you hurt yourself,
it's like writing.
It's still better. I did it than not, right? So with meditation, And I've been taking a class once a week with an instructor, but I'm doing it. I try to do it 7 days a week. I think I'm good at least 6 days a week at doing it. And it's 20 minutes. And what I do is I actually count backwards from 108, breathe in one nostril, out the other, count my breath. And that is able to distract my mind enough that I can sort of just focus on my breath. And I will have to say that even though I feel like during that 20 minutes, the amount of time that I'm not thinking other things is like 9 seconds at most, I have noticed in my life the ability for me to, in the moment, take a step back, notice things, be a little more mindful. So clearly it's working because I have seen the benefit. So even though when I'm doing it, I feel like I'm just doing it wrong, I think that everyone's doing it wrong. And at least what my teacher says is that in a lot of ways, the practice isn't the focus on your breath. It's the coming back to it. It's the realizing, hey, I need to be focused on my breath, not scolding yourself for it, but just returning your focus to it. And that's what really builds the muscle. And so it's kind of like the only way to do it is just to do it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's my homework here. Well, Bradley, this was awesome. We should have more of these conversations, really, especially about wellness. Like, I'm so fascinated by your journey. People go out there and read it. It's called My Wellness Routine is Killing Me. And of course, go out there and grab Bradley's books, The Fixer, and Obvious in Hindsight, and check out Tusk Ventures and Tusk Philanthropy. And anything else you want to plug while we're here?
Oh, yeah, I have a podcast called Firewall. Yeah, you've been on it. Yes. You've been a guest. So it's called Firewall. If you like the stuff that Rob and I just talked about, I think our tagline is Tech, Politics, and the Pursuit of Happiness.
There we go.
So check it out.
Well, everybody, thank you for listening. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Our voicemail is 321-200-0570. We'll talk to you later this week.